Currencies galore, and the U.S. dollar is at an all-time low. With today's gloomy economic outlook, safe investments are often hard to find. For over a decade, Melody Cederstrom at Discount Gold and Silver Trading Company has been helping people secure their future by investing in the precious metals. Melody has the honesty, integrity, and experience that is often lacking in the precious metals business. Let her put it to work for you. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188.
Dial 911 and Die, the book police chiefs and politicians don't want you to read, shows there is no legal obligation for the police to protect you. Just ask yourself, if the police aren't obligated to protect my family and I'm disarmed by legislation, what if...
A burglar!
Dial 911 and Die is available from Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. Order it online at jpfo.org.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70, and worldwide on the Internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
The Sammy Hess son of Hollywood lost his faith in all that's good. Closed the curtain, unplugged the clock, hung his clothes on the shower rod, but he never got undressed, and no, he never made a mess.
Gentlemen, welcome to another edition of American Exposé. Darren Wicks here with you on June 20th, 2005, and I'm so glad you joined us for another action-packed hour of exposing the globalists and the United Nations system being implemented in America and all across the world. There are many conferences that are going on right now, a couple of that have just concluded within the last couple of weeks. We're going to cover a little bit of that tonight, and we're certainly not going to get into all of it because you can read this stuff and we'd eat up the whole hour because these people, one thing these globalists can do, they have plenty of time on their hands, they have plenty of staff working for them, and they have a plenty of money. And a lot of people give to these groups without even realizing it because their public service announcements are on late at night and they see something for some earth-promoting, earth-loving organization and they say, oh, I like nature. Maybe I'll give a little money to this. And not even realizing it, but they are promoting, they're giving to do away with individual liberty and the undermining of their private property rights. Now, ladies and gentlemen, tonight we're going to be discussing a little bit about Kyoto, not directly, but indirectly, as just as I suggested on this program that it looks to me like this thing is being implemented, even though the treaty has never been ratified. We've heard a lot of howling and screaming about how the United States is the biggest polluter of the world, and yet there's nothing anywhere that everyone seems to fail to remember that the United States is the biggest country that feeds the world. As the world's largest, well, at one time anyway, I don't know about now, the largest industrial country on the face of the planet, we've fed more people in this world than any other country in the world. And yet that little piece of wisdom somehow seems to escape these people that attempt to demonize Americans and what we stand for. Well, what do we stand for in this day and age? That's the question. Historically, this country has been a beacon of freedom and liberty. And yet the word freedom today is being redefined in Orwellian terms to mean something that certainly freedom hasn't meant for 200 years that this country has been in existence. What does freedom mean today? I don't know what our governmental leaders who are embroiled in globalism around the world mean by the term freedom. I have a pretty good idea what they mean by democracy, and it isn't what you think it is. Well, many of you know what it is, but I'm talking about primarily new listeners. But these redefining of terms go forward even as the agenda does. Now, there's a conference coming up. I have some information here from the International Institute for Sustainable Development, which is based in Canada. They say we are pleased to announce the Asia-Europe Environment Forum Conference, one-third of the planet, what can Asia and Europe do for sustainable development? The date will be the 23rd to the 25th of November, 2005. Bidakara, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, at the Bidakara Convention Center in Jakarta, Indonesia. The Asia-Europe Environment Forum is co-organized by the Asia-Europe Foundation, or the ASEF, the Hans Seidel Foundation, HSF, of Germany, the Institute for Global Environmental Strategies, the IGES of Japan, and the United Nations Environment Program, UNEP. They got all these letters. One-third of our planet, what can Asia and Europe do for sustainable development? Is proudly hosted by the Indonesian Biodiversity Foundation. In terms of population, they say, Asia-Europe meeting countries from Asia and Europe constitute close to a third of the world's population. The conference aims to be a platform for dialogue on environment and sustainable development issues. The event promises to be the largest meeting of its kind, drawing up to 250 high-profile international personalities from Asia and Europe. An Indonesian and a European speaker will open the thing, prominent in the field of environment and sustainable development. They'll deliver the keynote address to open the event. The event shall be a converging point for a number of workshops hosted by organizations prominent in the field of the environment and sustainable development. Anyway, they go on in some detail in this, and I don't want to bore you, but I just, one of our purposes here, since you're probably not going to hear too much about these conferences on the mainstream media, is to let you know that they're going on. Meanwhile, there's some others that have just concluded. Here we see the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. This is a big one. It's a seminar on the development and transfer of environmentally sound technologies for adaptation to climate change. And this comes, again, from the International Institute for Sustainable Development, the Earth Negotiations Bulletin, which, by the way, if you want to keep track of these things, I don't know how many of you out there are interested, but we all should be interested in this stuff, because this, folks, is the real issue right here. The stuff that's going on with the UN, this is why I'm so adamant about covering this stuff, because this goes to the root of your environmental or your private property rights. What happens with the environment and what they're saying is happening with the environment and your development? Well, really, wealth, everything. Everything comes down to this. And it has a very significant impact. This is the globalist way of pushing us off all of humanity into the cages. Now, this Earth Negotiation Bulletin says the United Nations Forum on Climate Change seminar on the development and transfer of environmentally sound technologies for adaptation to climate change, the UN Framework Convention, it took place June 14th to the 16th, 2005, and they say the UNFCCC seminar on the development and transfer of environmentally sound technologies for adaptation to climate change convened from the 14th to the 16th of June 2005 at the Hilton Hotel in Tobago, Trinidad. The seminar was convened following a request from the UNFCCC's subsidiary body for scientific and technological advice. At its 20th session in June 2004, for the UNFCCC Secretariat to organize a seminar on the development and transfer of environmentally sound technologies for the adaptation to climate change. Now, skipping down here a little bit because I don't want to bore you. They say the seminar provided an opportunity for different experts to exchange views and experiences on a range of activities relating to ESTs for adaptation to climate change. Topics addressed include concepts, needs for, and identification and evaluation of technologies for adaptation, experiences, and lessons learned, and possible next steps in developing, transferring, and applying these technologies. What are they talking about here? They're talking about technologies for, well, for example, cleaner energy, cleaner burning fuels. That would be an example of an environmentally sound technology. And, of course, windmills are a part of this. And windmills, it takes an awful lot of windmills to generate the same amount of power as it does, you know, for coal-burning plants and things that they view as pollutants, high-polluting, environmentally polluting plants, energy sources. They continue, they say, 50 representatives of governments, intergovernmental and non-governmental organizations, business and industry groups, and academic institutions attended the workshop. Plenary sessions on Tuesday, June 14th, and Wednesday, June 15th, provided an overview of the issue of development and transfer of ESTs, that's environmentally sound technologies, and adaptation to climate change, explored ongoing activities and possible synergies, and identified technologies for adaptation to climate change. On Wednesday afternoon, on Thursday, June 16th, participants convened in two parallel working groups to discuss technologies for adaptation in the context of the UNFCCC. The meeting concluded with a roundtable debate on ways forward. What to do going forward, I take it that's what that means. Now, they say climate change is considered to be one of the most serious threats to sustainable development, with adverse impacts expected on the environment, human health, food security, economic activity, natural resources, and physical infrastructure. What do we reference here but the Hegelian dialectic, ladies and gentlemen? Because all of these things that they're talking about here can be manipulated for a purpose, and that purpose is to put you in the frame of thought to accept that these are real problems that have to be dealt with. Global climate, they continue, varies naturally, but scientists agree that rising concentrations of anthropogenically produced greenhouse gases in the Earth's atmosphere are leading to changes in the climate. According to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, the effects of climate change have already been observed. And why should we believe the Intergovernmental Plan on Climate Change, I ask? The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change would be an arm of the United Nations. Intergovernmental. What do they mean by intergovernmental? Governments coming together to cooperate. Who oversees the process but the UN? They say, though, that the effects of climate change have already been observed, and scientific findings indicate that precautionary and prompt action is necessary. Once again, we have a crisis. The international political response to climate change began with the adoption of the United Nations Forum on Climate Change in 1992. The UNFCCC sets out a framework for action aimed at stabilizing atmospheric concentrations in greenhouse gases in order to avoid dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. Controlled gases include methane, nitrous oxide, and in particular carbon dioxide. The UNFCCC entered into force on the 21st of March, 1994, and now has 189 parties. And then they go on about technology transfer. They say technology transfer is considered a key element in combating climate change under the UNFCCC. And again, the UNFCCC is the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Transfer technology is considered a key element of this. Technology transfer activities have been on the agenda of every session of the SBSTA and the Conference of the Parties to the UNFCCC. The Framework Convention, Article 4.5, which addresses the need for technology transfer, states that, quote, developed country parties shall take all practicable steps to promote, facilitate, and finance, as appropriate, the transfer of or access to environmentally sound technologies and know-how to other parties, particularly developing country parties, to enable them to implement the provisions of the convention. In this process, they continue, the developed country parties shall support the development and enhancement of endogenous capacities and technologies of developing country parties, unquote. At COP7, held in November 2001 in Marrakesh, Morocco, parties decided to establish an expert group on technology transfer to support the work of the SBSTA in advancing the convention's technology-related goals. Since 2002, the EGTT, again the Expert Group on Technology Transfer, has met several times, adopting work programs and providing input and advice to the SBSTA on technology transfer. During that time, the expert group considered a variety of issues, focusing in particular on information dissemination, enabling environments for the transfer of environmentally sound technologies, and technology needs assessments. Well, I'm not going to go any further with that because we could probably read for days on just this one conference. And this is just one summary, the final summary of this one conference. Now, looking around, we see that MSNBC does a piece on the Environmental Protection Agency. They say the new rules to clean air in national parks. New rules to clean air in national parks. This is from MSNBC. EPA directs state officials to identify, reduce emissions. And this is from the Associated Press. They say new regulations intended to improve the air in national parks and wilderness areas will require hundreds of power plants, steel mills, and similar facilities to cut pollution by 1 million tons a year. Now, what did we tell you folks out there that Kyoto was going to be implemented even without it being ratified? And here we see that the Environmental Protection Agency is beginning to implement these regulations, regulate these plants. And it's being done without any lawmaking body that I can see passing any rules. It's all regulatory. The Environmental Protection's rules, they continue, issued Wednesday, directs state officials to specify what plants will have to make the cuts and by how much. Now, how are they able to specify or mandate that the states do this? It's called regional governance, ladies and gentlemen, and it's called using the carrot and the stick approach. Because states which don't implement the Environmental Protection Agency's mandates don't get the cash. And that's the problem. Jeff Holmsted, head of air quality for the Environmental Protection Agency, said, quote, states are now required to go out and identify these facilities and then determine what the best available retrofit technology is. He said, we don't expect that any states will fail to do this, unquote. That's because they have it all. They have the states so desperate for cash that they're willing to comply with just about anything. Very important to work with state legislatures and state legislators to stop this implementation of the world globalist system. As part of a 2003 court settlement with an environmental group, New York-based Environmental Defense, the EPA, agreed to have states impose limits on air pollution, often from sources hundreds of miles away, to reduce haze and visibility problems in 156 national parks and wilderness areas. States will now have to submit new plans by December 2007 on how they plan to do it. The biggest impacts will be in the Great Smoky Mountains and other parks in the southeast, and in western parks such as Yellowstone and the Grand Canyon. Haze is produced mainly by nitrates and sulfates that scatter and absorb light in the atmosphere. Homestead said that beginning in 2014, industrial facilities will have to cut 1 million tons of pollution a year, 600,000 tons of nitrogen oxides, and 400,000 tons of sulfur dioxide. The EPA estimates it will cost, now listen to this, folks, the EPA estimates it will cost about $1.5 billion a year to achieve the reduction, but puts the annual benefits at $8.5 billion to $10 billion. Now, how are we going to reap those benefits? Well, through fewer premature deaths, non-fatal heart attacks, hospital admissions, and lost school and work days. In other words, things that you can't really nail down as being the cause of environmental issues. Fatal heart attacks? How are you going to prove that a fatal heart attack is due to the environment? Environmental pollution. Premature deaths. How can you prove, how many premature deaths can be proven to be environmentally related? That's the question. Hospital admissions? This is just incredible. But see, once again, the truth doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is the agenda, and they say, oh, look, less people will have heart attacks if we get this thing. Oh, never mind, we'll spend the $1.5 billion. Look at the benefits. The truth of the matter is, folks, there are no real benefits. Oh, maybe we'll have cleaner air? Maybe we won't. The EPA expects an addition, but the bottom line is it's not about cleaner air anyway. What it's about is curtailing your human development, because you evil human beings out there are destroying everything, and you have to be put into cages so that the ecosystem and the environment and the animals, all of this stuff can prosper. The EPA expects an additional $240 million a year in benefits from increased tourism, they say. Some areas will benefit more, Homestead said, because they're more polluted than other areas. We are predicting improvements in all of them. So there you have it. MSNBC reports that, and of course that they just carried it. That was from the Associated Press. June 16th was what that article was dated. Meanwhile, we have another UN conference that has just concluded, and this was the conference, on the oceans. This one was June 13th to the 15th, 2005, and it says the second international workshop on the regular process for global reporting and assessment of the state of the marine environment, including socioeconomic aspects, was held from June 13th to the 15th, 2005, at UN headquarters in New York. The workshop brought together over 100 representatives from governments and intergovernmental organizations. The second international workshop set in place the first building blocks of the assessment of assessments, the startup phase for the GMA process, a stocktaking and gap analysis of existing assessments of the state of the marine environment. Now, I'm going to skip down a little bit, because I don't want to run out of time. They say, under the brief history of the Law of the Sea, because this is what this ties to, is the Law of the Sea Treaty. They say, on November 1st, 1967, Malta's ambassador to the UN, Arvid Pardo, asked the nations of the world to recognize a looming conflict that could devastate the oceans. In a speech to the United Nations General Assembly, he called for, quote, an effective international regime over the seabed and the ocean floor beyond a clearly defined national jurisdiction. Can they say it any plainer than that? The speech set in motion a process that spanned 15 years and saw the creation of the United Nations Seabed Committee, the signing of a treaty banning nuclear weapons on the seabed, the adoption of the declaration by the General Assembly that all resources of the seabed beyond the limits of national jurisdiction are the common heritage of mankind, and the convening of the Stockholm Conference on Human Environment. These were some of the factors that led to the convening of the third UN Conference on the Law of the Sea, during which the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, or UNCLOS, was adopted. UNCLOS opened for signature on December 10, 1982 in Montego Bay, Jamaica. At the third UN Conference on the Law of the Sea, UNCLOS sets forth the rights and obligations of states regarding the use of the oceans. Did you hear that? I want to say that again. UNCLOS, UNCLOS, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, sets forth the rights and obligations of states, read countries, regarding the use of the oceans, their resources, and the protection of the marine and coastal environment. UNCLOS, which entered into force on the 16th of November, 1994, comprises 320 articles and 9 annexes, and is supplemented by the 1994 Deep Seabed Mining Agreement and the 1995 Fish Stocks Agreement. Since the entry into force of UNCLOS, three relevant international bodies have been established: the International Seabed Authority, the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, and the Commission on the Limits of the Continental Shelf. We have to take a break here real soon. The United Nations Conference on Environment and Development was held in June 1992 in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Chapter 17 of Agenda 21, the program of action adopted in Rio, addresses, quote, the protection of the oceans, all kinds of seas, including enclosed and semi-enclosed seas and coastal areas, and the protection, rational use, and development of their living resources, unquote. The provisions of Chapter 17 are the fundamental framework for action to achieve the sustainable development of oceans and seas. The UNEP, or that is the United Nations Environment Program, Governing Council Decision 21-13 and follow-up meetings. At its 21st session, the Governing Council, and that took place in February 5th to the 9th of 2001, the Governing Council of the UN Environment Program adopted a decision, I'm not going to read you the specific decision, on the global assessment of the state of the marine environment, whereby the Governing Council requested the UNEP to explore the feasibility of establishing a regular process for the assessment of the state of the marine environment. Following this decision, two meetings were held in September 2001 and in March of 2002 to consider possible modalities for the process. I'm going to leave that right there, folks, because we're going to go to break here in just a moment. But Chapter 17 of Agenda 21, the entire Agenda 21 document is posted there at AmericanExpose.com. American spelled with a K, not a C. As is a lot of research for your perusal and to garner for yourself understanding of what we're facing as this agenda goes forward. And on the other side of the break, I started some information about the Asian tsunami on last Friday's program, but I didn't get to the rebuilding clip that I wanted to play from CBS News. I think that's kind of important, so I want to play it tonight for you. So we're going to be going to the break right now, but after the break I want to play this, because sustainable development communities, sustainable communities are being built right now in the tsunami region. And all of this was made possible by the tsunami. Was it a created crisis? Well, we don't know. there's really no way to find out for sure. All I do know is if it wasn't, it sure did play into the hands of the globalists, as they never cease to seize the opportunity of any crisis to further their ends. That's why we all need to be awake to what they're doing, to their tactics and methods, and that's why we do what we do here. We'll continue on the other side of the break. Stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. A lot more information to come.
The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests, and are not necessarily those of the First Amendment Radio Network or its affiliated radio stations.
Who are you? That is the question, and the name of the program. To learn what the question means and what the answers are, tune in every Sunday afternoon and Rice McLeod will give you the answers. Who are you? Check the schedule pages at firstamendmentradio.com for broadcast times. We'll see you then.
Maybe your friends think I'm just a stranger. My face you hear.
If you'd like to get a copy of this program, there are a few ways that we can help you. You may subscribe at firstamendmentradio.com for only $45 a month, and you'll receive an MP3 CD weekly of all of our programs. As a bonus, we'll send you a password for our audio archives online. That's a $15 value. Or you may request any month of any program on one MP3 CD for a minimum donation of only $25. Or any single program on tape, MP3 CD, or CD for only $15. You may do all of this online at firstamendmentradio.com. Just follow the instructions to make a donation or subscribe. You may also adopt an hour of your favorite program. Please don't forget that most of the programs on firstamendmentradio.com are listener-supported. Don't do internet? Then call 559-781-3773 and we'll be honored to help you. Thank you from all of us here at firstamendmentradio.com.
Nations wants us all as poor as they come, and if they have their way, the agenda moves forward, we'll be as poor as they come, as they're spending us broke right now with wars here and there and everywhere. And to that end, ladies and gentlemen, we want to move a little bit toward war news. I have before me some information from Kentucky.com. The headline is, Mother of Dead Soldier Vilifies Bush Over War. President ridiculed at interfaith rallies. She says, now, the people that are doing this, I think they're democratically oriented, so there might be some politics involved, and we've demonstrated time and again on this program that there's no difference between the parties. So we're not buying into the dialectic here. I just want to make that clear. But it says, the president of Gold Star Families for Peace, and I don't know anything about this group, a mother who lost a son in Iraq criticized the United States, quote, illegal and unjust war, unquote, yesterday during an interfaith rally in Lexington. Cindy Sheehan of Vacaville, California, accused President Bush of lying to the nation about a war which has consumed tens of billions of dollars and claimed more than 1,700 American lives, including the life of Army Specialist Casey Austin Sheehan. Sheehan was one of more than a dozen activists who were scheduled to speak at yesterday's anti-war rally at the Red Mile, which was organized by the Clergy and Laity Network and co-sponsored by dozens of liberal religious organizations. I'm wondering how many of these organizations have ties to socialist, communist entities. See, that's the problem here. As Chris has said on this program recently, the communists are saying the same thing in many respects that we are. They claim that they're against the wars. I remember reading about the Iraqi Communist Party. After the United States went into Iraq and invaded and overthrew Saddam Hussein, the U.S. government put, as a part of the interim government, the Iraqi Communist Party. And yet we were told that we were liberating the people of Iraq. Well, liberating them by putting communists in rule over them? But yet, I remember going to the Iraqi Communist Party's website and reading on there that they opposed the war, which actually put them into office, into power. They didn't agree with the war, but they were glad that Saddam Hussein, who was hunting down the communists prior to his ousting, they were glad he was out of power. Now I want you folks to think about that for a moment. According to this report, and this was reported in World at Daily, and I'm sure the article's on there somewhere, it was called Red Flags Over Baghdad, I think was the headline. But you have an example here of the Hegelian dialectic at work. The Iraqi Communist Party was against the war, and yet here they are in power because of it. Continuing here, they say Sheehan ridiculed Bush for saying it's hard work comforting the widow of a soldier who has been killed in Iraq. She said, quote, "Hard work is seeing your son's murder on CNN one Sunday evening while you're enjoying the last supper you'll ever truly enjoy again. Hard work is having three military officers come to your house a few hours later to confirm the aforementioned murder of your son, your firstborn, your kind and gentle sweet baby. Hard work is burying your child 46 days before his 25th birthday. Hard work is holding your other three children as they lower the body of their big brother into the ground. Hard work is not jumping in the grave with him and having the earth cover you both." Unquote. Since her son's death, Sheehan has made opposition to the Bush administration a full-time job. She said, quote, "We're watching you very carefully, and we're going to do everything in our power to have you impeached for misleading the American people. Beating a political stake in your back and your black heart will be the fulfillment of my life," unquote, she said, as the audience of 200 people cheered. But you know, when I read something, and that's certainly what she had to say is the reason why I shared this article with you, but there is a human toll on both sides of any war. And the anguish that's expressed in that statement, it tears me up when I see these tributes to fallen heroes on the CBS Evening News. It tears me up. But I'll bet she's a Kerry supporter. I'll bet she supports Kerry. She probably voted for him. And what would Kerry do but completely take away your private property rights? Ratify the Kyoto Treaty. Or do what he could to get it ratified. In other words, he would continue with the same agenda that Bush is pushing forward through the wars. Kerry would continue by other means. They're all globalists. I want to move on here. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a terrorism update. And in tribute to the War on Terror, not really a tribute, but I want to present to you a compilation here. This is what we think of the War on Terror. It's just nothing but a big witch hunt.
But again, I want to tell the American people, we're doing everything we can at home, but you better have a president who chases these terrorists down and bring them to justice before they hurt us again.
Everybody looking in the new bad way in town.
We must deal with threats before they fully materialize.
Hop on the board and let the wind carry you around.
And the other lesson is that there are people who can't stand what America stands for. Desire to inflict great harm on the American people. We cannot let terrorists and rogue nations hold this nation hostile or hold our allies hostile. A global effort. We're facing a group of folks who have such hatred in their heart, they'll strike anywhere with any means. And that's why it's essential that we have strong alliances, and we do.
There are some who feel like that if they attack us, that we may decide to leave prematurely. They don't understand what you're talking about, that's the case.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person that gets to decide, not you.
I'm the person that gets to decide, not you. Yeah, there's boogeymen everywhere. We're on another witch hunt, ladies and gentlemen, and that's what it's going to be. As the Project for a New American Century report goes forward, North Korea, Iran, Syria, where does it stop? China? That also is marked for democratization. And now we're starting to see where they talk about how China is a threat. It's a threat to its neighbors. It's a threat. Well, who made the threat? We made the threat by funding them in the first place, by building up their economy, by doing business with the terrorists. Isn't that interesting? But here we see from CNN, CIA chief has excellent idea where bin Laden is. Now, this is something that came out this past week. Actually, it's dated June 20th. So that's today. So CIA Director Porter Goss says he has an excellent idea, quote-unquote, where Osama bin Laden is hiding, but that the al-Qaeda chief will not be caught until weak links in the war on terrorism are strengthened. Weak links. Now we're going to find out what those weak links are. In an interview with Time magazine published Sunday, Goss said part of the difficulty in capturing bin Laden was, quote, sanctuaries in sovereign nations, unquote. That's always the problem with these globalists, isn't it? These sovereign nations. Got to get rid of these weak links, these sovereign nations. Are you listening to this, folks? I hope you are, because they're admitting here where the weak links are in the war on terrorism. They're those nasty sovereign nations. What we need is a world without borders so that we can go and get these bad guys anywhere they're hiding. Continuing with the piece, it says that the magazine asked Goss when bin Laden would be captured. He said, quote, that is a question that goes far deeper than you know. In the chain that you need to successfully wrap up the war on terror, we have some weak links, and I find that until we strengthen all the links, we're probably not going to be able to bring Mr. bin Laden to justice. Now, folks, we got an article on sweetliberty.org in the war section, 911.sweetliberty.org. If you go in there, there is an article there where a general is saying he admits that capturing bin Laden is not a part of the mission. And I believe the article is dated October of 2001. He admitted right from the very start that capturing bin Laden was not a part of the whole objective of the war on terror. And here we see the CIA director, Porter Goss, saying that the question of bin Laden goes far deeper than you know. In the chain that you need to successfully wrap up the war on terror, we have some weak links. And I find that until we strengthen all the links, we're probably not going to be able to bring Mr. bin Laden to justice. He says, we're making very good progress on it, but when you go to the very difficult question of dealing with sanctuaries in sovereign states, you're dealing with a problem of our sense of international obligation. Fair play. We have to find a way to work in a conventional world in unconventional ways that are acceptable to the international community. See, there it is right there. Acceptable to the international community. We have to put the international community in charge. We have to find a way to work in a conventional world, he said, in unconventional ways that are acceptable to the international community. Unquote. Now, asked whether that meant he knew where bin Laden was, he responded, quote, I have an excellent idea where he is. What's the next question? Goss did not say where he thinks bin Laden is, nor did he name the country or countries he was referring to when he spoke of sanctuaries. But intelligence experts have long said they believe bin Laden was probably hiding in the rugged mountainous border region of Pakistan and Afghanistan. Asked if Al-Qaeda could strike the United States again, of course he said yes it could. Certainly the intent is very high, and we are trying to stay ahead of their capability. And so far I think we've done pretty well at carrying the war to them, as it were. I think that's matter, he said. So, what are we saying here? The weak links in the war on terror is your national sovereignty. In the national sovereignty of every other country on the face of the earth. The war on terror, ladies and gentlemen, is a United Nations war. It is a war for globalization. Most of you are aware of that, but for the small percentage of new listeners that have come on board, if anybody doubted it before, you shouldn't doubt it now. Because here's the director of the CIA, who, by the way, is a skull and bonesman, I understand, for what that's worth, to those of you who know what that's about. He's admitting this. So the witch hunts will continue as we continue to track down all the boogeymen who are supposedly threatening us. Now, time's getting away, and I don't want to eat up all the time with editorial comment here. The tsunami, December 26th of 2004, took place. This, as I think I pretty well documented on Friday's broadcast, this is a massive United Nations rebuilding effort. As Clinton has said, there's literally hundreds of NGOs that are involved, and of course the American Red Cross is the biggest of that, which cannot seem to donate the funds that they collect to the actual purposes and people for which they collected them. But nevertheless, this CBS News last Thursday did a piece on the tsunami rebuilding effort, and this is what it sounded like.
You would think that 6 months after the tsunami, there would be a lot of progress here in the hardest hit part of Banda Aceh. Obviously, that is not the case. Government officials admit the reconstruction has been slowed by bureaucratic red tape, but now, finally, it is beginning to happen. Echoing across the fields of debris are the first sounds of hope. Thanks to people like Graham Rapley. He spent his life in construction, but he's never built anything like this, a whole new village to be called Chulpaya.
The medical clinic's just over there, and the school's going to go over here.
It's going to be
a sustainable community, ladies and gentlemen.
A community, when it's done.
I'm very proud to be part of it.
You're the mayor, just for the moment.
Yeah, just for the moment.
He works for IOM, the International Organization for Migration.
Now remember that name, because we're going to come back to it after this is done.
Funded in part by groups like the American Red Cross. What do you want to leave here besides a lot of structures when you're done?
We are going to establish a livelihood for them.
A way to make a living?
A way to make a living, yes. Because if we don't, this place is just going to fall to pieces.
And it is construction jobs that will keep this place from falling to pieces. Jobs like these at this yard, making the concrete beams for the houses at Chilpaya and for thousands more houses to come. It means 3,500 people throughout the area have work. Algus Salim is earning money working here, where he will also be among the first residents. We ask him how it feels to have a job and a new house for his family. The smile was answer enough. At this nearby village, some people have already moved in, and they're getting a prized possession, donated Tupperware to store fresh water and food, delivered by people from the U.S. charity, AmeriCares. Every hammered nail is an echo of hope. It has taken months, but life is finally getting better. Barry Peterson, CBS News, Banda Aceh, Indonesia.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, sustainable communities are being built in the tsunami region. Now, this group that he's talking about, IOM, they have a website, and this is located at www.iom.int. I looked them on the looked them up on the web just before the broadcast. Their mission statement is all about migration. Migration. Just like we have going on here in the United States, migration deals with the elimination of the borders. Is the tsunami to further border elimination in Asia? It says, IOM is committed to the principle that humane and orderly migration benefits migrants and society. As the leading international organization for migration, IOM acts with its partners in the international community to assist in meeting the growing operational challenges of migration management, advance understanding of migration issues, encourage social and economic development through migration, and uphold the human dignity and well-being of migrants. Here's what they do. After half a century of worldwide operational experience, they say, IOM has become the leading international organization working with migrants and governments to provide humane responses to migration challenges. Established in 1951 as the Intergovernmental Organization to Resettle European Displaced Persons, Refugees and Migrants, IOM has now grown to encompass a variety of migration management activities throughout the world. With offices and operations on every continent, IOM helps governments and civil society through rapid humanitarian responses to sudden migration flows, post-emergency return and reintegration programs, assistance to migrants on their way to new homes and lives, facilitation of labor migration, assisted voluntary return for irregular migrants, recruitment of highly qualified nationals for return to their countries of origin, aids to migrants in distress, training and capacity building of officials, measures to counter trafficking in persons, migration medical and public health programs, mass information and education on migration, research related to migration management, and other services for migrants. While not a part of the United Nations system, IOM maintains close working relations with UN bodies and operational agencies. IOM has as partners a wide range of international and non-governmental organizations. Quote, migration will be one of the major policy concerns of the 21st century. Did you hear that? They say migration will be one of the major policy concerns of the 21st century. In our shrinking world, more and more people will look to migration, temporary or permanent, as a path to employment, education, freedom, or other opportunities. Now, what are they saying here? More people will look to migration, temporary or permanent, as a path to employment. Do you think that the United States, do you think we're going to be starved out of this country? Do you think that we're going to be forced to go to other countries seeking employment? even as the Mexicans have come to the United States seeking jobs. And soon, under CAFTA, the Central American countries, the people there, well, they've already started migrating in other places. What's going on here? It's called integration. Ladies and gentlemen, it's called removing the borders. And the tsunami furthered that agenda. They say governments will need to develop sound migration policies and practices. Properly managed, migration can contribute to prosperity. Oh, really? It can contribute to prosperity, development, and mutual understanding among people. IOM exists to help migrants with all their needs and to assist governments in managing migration for the good of all. And see, that's the point. That's the socialist system, the good of all. The good of the individual is supplanted to the good of all, the well-being of everyone. From each, what did Marx say? From each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. And they will decide what your needs are for you. Thank you. They continue here. They say, in reacting to conflicts and emergencies, speed and flexibility are essential if humanitarian needs are to be properly met. In the post-conflict rebuilding phase, IOM helps returnees restart their lives through a variety of individual and community programs. The human rights of migrants deserve greater attention. Trafficked migrants are routinely exploited, mistreated, or even killed. Migrant workers often find themselves without protection or recourse, either from their own government or in the country where they are working. IOM is dedicated to assisting migrants in distress. Well, we're running out of time here. But I just wanted to point that out and play that piece because that's just further proof that what goes on there, I believe the Asian tsunami was created. And they have the capability of doing that with the tsunami bomb. Now, moving along to some information that that Daniela sent me. And, of course, Dennis has been doing some good work. Steve, I appreciated Steve from, he sent me the piece that I covered last Monday with David Stahl on internationalizing U.S. roads, and I saw after the broadcast that Dennis had posted that on the website, so I appreciate that. Appreciate people working together and finding good information. That's what we need. And by the way, one more thing about this, this tsunami situation. Chapter 7 of Agenda 21 talks about promoting sustainable human settlement development. And I was going to share with you some from that chapter tonight, but we're just running out of time, so I wanted to get to this one last article here that Daniela sent me. And this is dated May 15, 2005. It talks about using nuclear weapons, and not just as a last resort. This is a piece from the Washington Post. It says, a global strike plan with a nuclear option. Early last summer, Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld approved a top-secret interim global strike alert order directing the military to assume and maintain readiness to attack hostile countries that are developing weapons of mass destruction, specifically Iran and North Korea. 2 months later, Lieutenant General Bruce Carlson, commander of the 8th Air Force, told a reporter that his fleet of B-2 and B-52 bombers had changed its way of operating so that it could be ready to carry out such missions. We're now at the point where we're essentially on alert, he said. We have the capacity to plan and execute global strikes.